Now we're going to transition to specifics of management with regards to region or type of surgery. And so Dr. Zager has been gracious enough to come and talk to us about how to manage injuries of the peripheral nerves that exist in the region of the neck. Dr. Zager.
Thank you, Charles. So that was an excellent introduction, and unfortunately that's an injury that I see too often. I've probably repaired 15 or 20 of those, and they're never happy patients. They are in a lot of pain, and even though it's a motor nerve, their shoulder function is completely screwed up, and so they are debilitated by that. So I think all of the lessons that Dr. Levin mentioned are very important to pay attention to. So I'm going to focus on nerves in the neck, and unfortunately there are many others besides the spinal accessory nerve to worry about. It's a very, as you know, a busy area with high-priced real estate and lots of things you can injure, even with a simple little lymph node biopsy. So I have no disclosures for this talk. I just want to pay tribute to my mentor, Dr. David Klein. He's the former chairman of neurosurgery at LSU and a real champion of nerve repair, nerve injury, and taught a whole generation of neurosurgeons and some plastic surgeons and orthopedic surgeons how to recognize these injuries, how to classify them, how to manage them medically, how to manage them surgically, when to operate, how to operate, what procedures to do. And he kept an incredible log of his outcomes, and he published many of these in a series of eloquent papers in our literature and also in his books, in combination with Alan Hudson from Toronto, who I also spent some time with. So he really taught me everything I know about nerve, and the mistakes that I make are certainly not his fault. So, as Charles mentioned, there are many mechanisms of potential injury to nerves. I won't spend time on this since he covered a lot of this, but in my mind, the most common are stretch injuries, retractors, and the bovie, unfortunately. We bovie through soft tissue and fat and fascia, and guess where nerves run? They run in the fat, right? So that's a common way, especially for sensory nerves, to be injured. And we dismiss it, oh, it's just a sensory nerve. Well, people can get painful neuromas, they can get dysesthesias, and have a Tinel's phenomenon. And so they're pretty unhappy. You may do an excellent job in managing the pathology, but if you screw up their sensory nerves and they're in pain afterwards, their incision is hypersensitive, they're not very happy patients. Needle injuries are seen quite commonly, and you have to recognize if you have a progressing neurological deficit from potentially a nerve injury, that's an urgent case. That may be a pseudoaneurysm, an expanding pseudoaneurysm or fistula. So that is, there are not many things that are emergencies in peripheral nerve surgery, but that's one of them. And if any invasive procedure can result in an expanding hematoma, and that you must pay attention to. Pressure palsies are the other common things we see. Fortunately, most of those do get better with time, but pay attention to how your patient is positioned, especially if you're using a lateral position, because that puts pressure on the nerves, like the ulnar, like the common peroneal, that are next to bone, crossing a joint, prone to stretch injury as well. And the brachial plexus, of course. Those are devastating injuries from various positions that we use in all types of surgery. So pay attention to that. And unfortunately, orthopedic procedures commonly produce nerve injuries. And I think our orthopedic colleagues are very aware of the potential risk that they put our nerves and blood vessels under when they do their stabilizing procedures, fixation and so forth. But these injuries still are unfortunately too common. There's a whole list of things that can cause iatrogenic injuries to the brachial plexus. I won't go into any detail, but anytime you're working in and around the neck and the chest, the plexus is at risk. Pay attention to it, protect it, prevention, and thinking about it. With any retractor, you know, you're focusing on the pathology, but any retractor can cause injury to the plexus, and those are devastating injuries and not always reversible with time. The nerves I'm going to run through quickly, nerves that are commonly injured in procedures that we do, and I am focusing mostly on neurosurgical procedures, but this applies to head and neck surgeons and thoracic surgeons, orthopedists, plastic surgeons, who will do a variety of these procedures in and around these triangles. Most of these focus on the anterior and posterior triangles, but if you think about posterior, midline posterior approaches, you can injure cervical nerve roots and even occipital nerves. For example, in a Chiari malformation procedure, you can injure occipital nerves, a retromastoid, an acoustic neuroma that Charles mentioned, you can injure branches of the greater and lesser occipital nerves and cause terrible, painful neuromas. So I'll run through these quickly. In the anterior triangle, besides the big nerves, you have to think about the smaller nerves, which can be devastating. The laryngeal nerves, of course, are classic in anterior cervical spine surgery for causing voice difficulties, hoarseness, and that may not be reversible. There are a variety of ENT procedures to correct vocal cord dysfunction, but they're not perfect. And the best approach is to avoid stretch injury to these nerves. We still see them in anterior cervical spine surgery all the time. And there's a debate about whether the left side approach is safer than the right side approach and so forth, but that problem has still not gone away. Vagus nerve we see all the time. In every carotid endarterectomy, we're dealing with it. We have to protect it. More often than not, it's not the vagus itself that gets injured, but one of its branches. Hypoglossal nerve, just last week in the clinic, I saw a lymph node biopsy in the anterior triangle. It wasn't a lymph node, it turned out to be a schwannoma. General surgeon did clamp, clamp, cut, cut, took the thing out, and the patient has a deviated atrophic tongue. So these things happen, and it's just, it's not that the surgeon didn't recognize that exactly what he was dealing with, he just didn't think of it as a possibility. He went in with only one pathologic diagnosis in mind. It's got to be a node. Well, every lump in the neck is not always a node. Marginal mandibular branch of the facial nerve, probably the most common nerve injury I see with carotid endarterectomy. Why is that? We retract upward on the jaw to get our distal exposure of the internal carotids. We see the end of the plaque. Well, if that's a fixed retractor, guess what you're going to nail? The marginal mandibular branch. And it's not a terrible functional palsy, but when the patient wakes up and tries to smile and their lip doesn't go down the way it should, their family thinks they've had a stroke. Well, it's not a stroke. It's a nerve injury, and it can be avoided. Glossopharyngeal nerve also can be an injury in any high anterior cervical procedure. More often than not, it presents with pain, and that's a terrible pain syndrome. You've heard of trigeminal neuralgia, whether it's glossopharyngeal neuralgia also. If it's due to a vessel in the posterior fossa, it's a beautiful operation that we do to decompress the glossopharyngeal nerve. It's not as common as the trigeminal nerve, but if it's an injury in the neck, that operation in the back of the head is not going to work. You need a nerve repair. I'm not going to run through the anatomy except to mention, as I said, that there's some controversy about which approach is best for anterior cervical discectomy and fusion. Many neurosurgeons will go to a left-sided approach in a lower anterior cervical spine procedure to try to take advantage of the fact that the course of the recurrent laryngeal nerve is a little more standardized and a little more consistent on the left side than it is on the right. But that's not true for all surgeons. I mentioned vagus nerve injury. That's our patient with the tongue atrophy after schwannoma resection in the neck. That still needs to be repaired. Marginal mandibular, I mentioned, that you can try Botox to even out the smile. These patients bite their lips, and it's a cosmetic problem, so it's not a minor thing. And glossopharyngeal neuralgia comes in several different forms. It's a devastating pain syndrome, shooting, lancinating electrical shocks into the throat, the ear, the neck, and it can be confused with Eagle syndrome, which the ENT surgeons will recognize from an elongated styloid process pressing on the glossopharyngeal nerve. So if you're exploring for that reason, be aware the nerve sits right there. In the posterior triangle, we mentioned the spinal accessory nerve. That's the most common one we see, but actually the most common devastating one. The most common one are the sensory nerves, as I mentioned earlier. The supraclavicular nerves are in the way to get to the brachial plexus. And what do? We bovie through the fat, and then the patient says, why do I have this burning pain on my chest and on my clavicle? Well, it's because you didn't pay attention to these sensory nerves. They're not big, but they're several sizable branches, and they can be preserved if you just put down the Bovie and go with your spreading technique and a bipolar and for cautery and not injure these nerves. They can be preserved, it just takes a few more minutes for the exposure. Phrenic nerve was mentioned earlier. That can be a pretty bad injury. We see it in neck exposures, we see it in the thoracic procedures, and certainly for thoracic outlet syndrome, probably the most commonly injured nerve, because where is it located? It runs right along the anterior border of the anterior scalene muscle. And what do we do to expose the thoracic outlet? We take out the anterior scalene or divide it. And so we have to move the phrenic nerve out of harm's way, and even just a gentle stretch on the nerve will knock out the function. If you check a chest x-ray on every patient who's had a posterior triangle procedure, many of them will have an elevated hemidiaphragm. Fortunately, it usually recovers if it's just gentle manipulation, but it can be symptomatic, especially in obese patients, in smokers, in elderly, and so forth. So it's a nerve to pay close attention to. And obviously the big set of nerves in the posterior triangle is the brachial plexus, and those are really the horrible injuries that I see. Unfortunately, a number of them are in iatrogenic circumstances. The cervical plexus, the main ones to be aware of around the head and neck area are the sensory nerves, the supraclavicular branches, but also the branches that go up to the face and the back of the head, lesser and greater occipital nerves, the great auricular nerve. Some of these nerves are actually useful as nerve grafts if you have to repair an important nerve like the spinal accessory. You can go down to the leg and get the sural nerve, or you can just take a local sensory nerve. But you have to warn your patient, hey, I may use this nerve, and you have to be willing to accept some numbness on the side of your, by your ear, or the side of your neck, or down onto your chest, and talk, have a discussion about it so there are no surprises postoperatively. It's a valid approach, but make sure you talk about it. So I'll skip through these again in the interest of time. This is the tiny incision that we often see with a lymph node biopsy. You can't even see it. It's a tiny 1 centimeter incision, but the patient ends up like this. And look at that right shoulder. It's drooping, it's painful, it's atrophic, the scapula doesn't work properly, the shoulder mechanics are completely thrown off, and these are miserable patients. They often have symptoms extending all the way down the arm and hand. You think it's a brachial plexus injury, it's just that there's so much traction on the plexus from the drooping of the shoulder that they get stretch symptoms into their hand and into their arm. It's not a plexus injury, it's a single nerve injury. It's not fair. And so you see what it does to the scapular motion, and it's easily separated from a long thoracic nerve injury, which can also produce dramatic winging because you see that droop of the shoulder and the atrophy of the shoulder. The only way that shoulder elevates is with a levator scapula muscle, which is a much smaller muscle, and the spinal accessory is much more important. So there's this poor gentleman's nerve that's been divided. And sometimes you can do a primary repair, but if it doesn't look healthy, you need a nerve graft, and this was a greater auricular nerve graft. You can harvest the sural nerve in various ways. Endoscopically can be done now as well, though it takes longer. And not for this case, usually it's a single nerve graft, but if it's a large nerve, like a plexus repair, you cut it up into cables and repair a large diameter nerve in that fashion. Greater auricular nerve, as I mentioned, is a fair nerve to use as a nerve graft, but make sure you tell the patient they're going to have a numb side of the neck and corner of the ear. Phrenic, I mentioned earlier, there it is, right coming off 3, 4, and 5 by the plexus crossing the anterior scalene, very vulnerable to injury in thoracic outlet cases, and that's what your chest x-ray looks like afterwards. Fortunately, usually not debilitating. And then the plexus. And I've seen all parts of the plexus injured, upper trunk, middle trunk, lower trunk, retroclavicular, depending on the type of procedure that's done. And probably the most common, unfortunately, is the transaxillary first rib resection, which is a beautiful operation if it's done carefully, but you're working through a long, narrow corridor. You don't visualize the plexus very well, and we've seen vessel injuries and we've seen plexus injuries from that approach. So that's not the favorite of neurosurgeons. We prefer to do an anterior supraclavicular approach, and we feel that if we're seeing the nerves, we're going to protect them better. But there are good results with both techniques, but I certainly see more of the transaxillary complications for first rib resection. And that's the area of thoracic outlet that we're looking at in between the anterior middle scalenes with the subclavian artery, all sandwiched into that narrow interscalene triangle. Tumor surgery in the neck is obviously known to produce nerve injuries, and if you're dealing with neurofibromatosis, which this poor guy has, then it's almost impossible to avoid it because every nerve in his neck has tumor in it. How do you treat this? How do you palliate this? Well, this is an 18-year-old kid, and so he's in for a lot of trouble. He's had needle biopsies. It's not cancer. It's not terrible pain. It's just he can't turn his neck. He's having trouble breathing at this point. Look at the size of this thing. Well, if you look at it carefully, it's actually not in the brachial plexus, so it's approachable surgically. There was a lot of nihilism about this case leading up to this, where people said, you can't have that operated on. Your arm functions normally, so leave it alone. His mother was a nurse, came for another opinion, and we said, well, let's look carefully at this and see if we can spare the brachial plexus. It turns out that the MRI showed that most of this plexiform tumor was in his cervical plexus. So if you explain that, yes, you're going to have some numbness on your chest wall after this, but we think we can preserve your arm function by debulking this, and you'll be able to turn your head. And so you go slowly, you monitor everything electrically, and you can peel out a huge amount of tumor, and the brachial plexus is down there in the vessel loops. And that's protected at the deep side by just repeatedly monitoring, stimulating, and we were able to get out a huge volume of tumor and preserve his arm function, his brachial plexus function. So it has to be done carefully, obviously. Same for cervical rib resections. They're notorious to distort the lower trunk of the plexus and to cause hand weakness and atrophy. But you have to mobilize the nerves in order to get the bone out safely. So that takes meticulous dissection, and it can't be done with lots of vigorous retraction. And that's, again, the supraclavicular approach. And I just mentioned for completion, the midline posterior approach, the cervical nerve root that we most often see injured with spine surgery, anterior or posterior approach, is C5. And we don't know exactly why that is. It's also L5 in the lumbar spine. But C5 happens when you do a multi-level corpectomy, multi-level discectomy, front or back, foraminotomy, and it's a debilitating injury. Not only shoulder function, but often biceps is lost. And those are patients who are very unhappy. I'll finish up. So in that approach from the back, pay attention to how much stretch is being put on C5, how much cautery is being applied to C5, and don't oversize your bone grafts when you do an anterior fusion because of the fact that you're going to stretch that C5 nerve root and cause a palsy. Just one other entity to be aware of, Parsonage-Turner syndrome, I'm sure you've all heard of it, goes by various names, neuralgic amyotrophy, et cetera. It can be easily confused with an iatrogenic nerve injury, but the history is totally different. So if you have an iatrogenic nerve injury, the patient wakes up with the palsy. But if they tell you they're fine in the postoperative period, but a week later, or a couple of weeks later, they develop severe shoulder pain, and then over the next week, 10 days, the pain gradually recedes, but they develop a progressive palsy of one or more nerves around the shoulder girdle or the upper arm. It can happen anywhere, but especially in the brachial plexus. That's a classic story of Parsonage-Turner. And nobody understands it completely. It's all sorts of descriptions of post-viral syndrome and post-anesthesia and so forth. But it's the classic history of debilitating shoulder pain followed with delayed atrophy and progressive palsy. And the thing to know is it usually gets better. Probably 80% of them recover on their own. It might take a year. It might take 2 years. But it's not a positioning palsy, it's not an iatrogenic nerve injury, and it's important medical legally, of course, because it doesn't point to the surgeon as the cause. So I'll stop there with time nerve repair, just in the interest of time, but I'll be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.